Good evening. So this is module 2, and it's the fifth talk, and we are continuing with the same book. The book is The Places That Scare You, A Guide to Fearlessness in Difficult Times by Pema Chodron. And we're continuing with chapter 17, which is called Bodhisattva Activity. And it's about the what are known as the six paramitas, or transcendent virtues. And these are generosity, patience, discipline, exertion, meditation, and prajna, which is sometimes called knowledge or wisdom. So last week, Emily gave a talk in which she covered the first three of these, which are generosity, patience, and discipline. So this week, we have to finish it up with the next three, which are exertion, meditation, and prajna. So the word paramita in Sanskrit means gone, beyond, gone to the other shore. And it conveys, at least classically, the image that we're leaving the shore of concern for self and crossing to the other shore of being a bodhisattva, which is that of a heroic person who dedicates his life for the enlightenment of everyone. So, last week, Emily read from Pema Chodron's book a somewhat different interpretation of, or at least a somewhat different image of paramita. Those of you who were here last week may recall this. This is the picture I prefer. In the middle of the river, with the shoreline out of view, the raft begins to disintegrate. We find ourselves with nothing to hold on to. From our conventional standpoint, this is scary and dangerous. However, one small shift of perspective will tell us that having nothing to hold on to is liberating. We could have faith that we won't drown. So that's a rather different image. It doesn't give us any security. It's groundlessness. And by the way, it's a metaphor. So we're not suggesting that you cross the street without looking and trust in God to get you to the other side. So how do we understand this? I'm going to get onto that in a little while and try to get it more practical. A little bit of quick review. The first paramita, generosity, which has three types of generosity: giving material things, giving the Dharma, which liberates, and giving protection from fear. And we talked about the threefold purity, which is when we see this from the view of prajna, then we have for generosity, no giver, no gift, and no receiver of the gift. So that's rather difficult to understand, especially if we haven't realized prajna yet. So it's very hard for us to understand this. And I found something which may be quite useful. It's in a really wonderful book. The book is called Wild Awakening. And this book is by Dzogchen Punlop Rinpoche, a teacher who we have met. He lives, I guess most of the time he lives in Seattle, I believe. And we do make some use of his course material because he's a very wonderful teacher. And he said things that make things marvelously clear. But I'm going to read something fairly extensive because it is so useful. So, right view is the threefold purity. The factor that determines whether our paramita practice is genuine is whether or not we hold the right view, which comes from our intention. In the most basic sense, right view is the understanding of threefold purity, which invokes the view of prajna, the insight into emptiness, shunyata. If we can invoke even a glimpse of emptiness or shunyata when we practice generosity or discipline or any of the other paramitas, then our practice will become pure. Threefold purity works with the purity of subject, the purity of object, and the purity of action. For example, in the case of generosity, the first aspect of threefold purity is the recognition of the egoless nature of the self, the one who performs the action of giving. The second aspect involves seeing the selfless nature of the recipient of the action of giving. The third aspect involves the recognition of the shunyata nature of the action itself. If there is no subject and no object, then logically there is no act. Okay. It's not helpful, right? In this way, the threefold view purifies the egocentric tendencies that arise in our practice of the paramitas. Most of us cannot begin our practice with the full realization of threefold purity. However, if we are able to engage in these practices without expectations, we will be moving closer to the practice of threefold purity. It is very difficult for an ordinary being to recognize that there is no self who is giving, no self who is receiving, and no action of giving. That is why if we begin by giving without expectation, then even if we have a sense of subject, object, and action, it will lead us towards the genuine practice of the paramitas. We are not thinking, I will get a little better because I am being generous and I practice discipline. If we expect these things to enrich our ego, then our paramita practice is not the practice of enlightenment. But if we can practice the paramitas without any notion of expectation, then it can lead us to the other shore because we are directly transcending our ego and our self-centered view. On that basis, we can later practice with threefold purity. However, we cannot accomplish threefold purity without the experience and practice of the view of shunyata. So it's still hard to hold on to. The path quality of paramita practice. Although threefold purity is strongly emphasized on the bodhisattva path, we must understand that we are on a path, We should not expect our practice to be completely pure, completely perfect, and completely transcendent right from the beginning. Shantideva, a great master of the Bodhisattva path, said that as ordinary persons we will have many thoughts. First we may have a thought of giving, and then we may have a second thought. No, no, I do not want to give that, I may need it. Shantideva said that these types of thoughts are natural and ordinary for ordinary bodhisattvas. However, he also said that we must work with these thoughts by maintaining a certain commitment to our vision of paramita practice. For instance, once we have a thought of giving, no matter what second thought we may have, we should try to give. It is important to recognize that although we struggle and have a certain sense of impurity in our practice, we are not failing. It does not mean that we are not practicing the paramitas or that we are not being successful on the path. With the aspiration to communicate with every living being, we can develop the vision of awakening sentient beings on the Bodhisattva path through any of the paramita practices. We can do this whether our path is Mahayana or Vajrayana. So I hope that gives us a little bit to work with. So we can't do it. We can't realize emptiness most of the time. What we can do, is to be mindful of how we're not doing it. Which is very important. We actually can do that, right? Using mindfulness of meditation, we can realize that we're not doing, that we're not realizing perfectly pure intention. And that is an enormous and valuable practice. Because normally people go around totally unaware of their motives. So simply being aware of our motives, being aware of what stops us from having pure motive, is actually doing the work which we are capable of doing now. So we all can do it. That's what I like about this passage, because it makes that so clear. So this is a great book. It covers a lot of material. And he's a very surprising teacher. He always comes up with interesting and unusual ways of looking at things that help you understand and catch your mind.
I have a question, Michael.
Yes.
When he's saying, if you're thinking about giving yeah. whatever it is, and then you like hesitate for whatever reason, you say, oh no, whatever, that you should try to give it anyway. Is that getting rid of the, I'm not going to do this, is that part of the purifying? That you just, when you have that generous...
Well, it's not retreating, right?
Right.
I mean, we may still not give. I mean, it may be that what we aspire to give is too much for us to give now. So even then, we may not succeed in giving, even if we may not even do a forced giving. We may say, I'm not ready to do that. But all he's saying here is, be mindful of what's happening. Be mindful of what we're doing. Watch our mind as we struggle and find we can't do it. And we will move along the path almost without knowing it, just by doing that.
What I struggle with sometimes people when I say, okay, I'm going to give this, and I give it, and then I think, oh, I wish I could ask for it back.
Yeah.
You can't. Or you can, but it's not good.
Well, you can. Whatever it is, you know, maybe you do have to ask for it back. Maybe it was unreasonable. Yeah.
I've been listening to This Moment is the Perfect Teacher, Pema Chodron. And from what I hear, she says, honor where you're stuck. And that's okay, but it's real important to recognize it.
Mm.
And if you're not comfortable going beyond where you're stuck, don't.
Mm.
But just recognizing it and honoring it means that every time you see where you're stuck or where your stuff comes up, eventually you'll be able to ease yourself to another place. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That's what I'm getting from
yeah.
This moment is the perfect teacher.
No, but it's funny because I'll give stuff that really is fine to give, but then lose that.
But maybe the act of doing, the consciousness that goes with it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think she's saying
non-detachment. It's like we are attached to things too much. As in our daily lives, like we own everything, clothes, everything. And we are so emotionally attached to give away those emotions,
yeah.
basically. And being mindful means being observant about that. The fact that I'm giving it, and I did love this earlier, but I really want to give it now. And being mindful, giving with that, so that emotion of getting it back would not be there.
Mm-hmm.
So you leave it there. So that's what, just staying in it and just being observant.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we are trying to do with meditation also.
Trungpa Rinpoche adds another aspect to this, actually, although I guess it's implied here too, which is that what we're really doing with generosity is giving up the, or at least trying to give up the egotistical displays that we make at the time that we're doing it. In other words, if we're giving but we find that we're angry about something, such as we're giving but we're angry because there's injustice which is creating the problem, which is why we're giving, or we're giving but we have some pride in giving. Again, what we're really giving up is not so much even material things, but giving up the emotional attachments which drive us. So he's less concerned with what it is that we give, and more with can we go beyond the emotional motives that we normally hold when we act. So, I know I'm doing a little bit of review, and let's see. Roberta is not here. But you had quite an interchange with her on. So what about discipline? It turns out that discipline is that there really is no fixed rules about it. We can set out, in an ordinary sense, the rules of decency about not misconduct that causes harm, and not harming others with our body actions, not hurting others with how we communicate or talk, and not hurting others emotionally. But in the end, any fixed set of rules is not a paramita because it's an idea. So we're ultimately in with prajna. One is simply being there, being appropriate, and doing what has to be done in the situation. And there were some crazy situations which came up last week, as I recall. And occasionally they do come up. But to be a transcendental discipline, we need to realize that it can't rely on our opinions or any fixed rules about what we're doing. That it has to rely on instantaneous insight, which is prajna. Trungpa has something to say about that. Trungpa Rinpoche. So there's a sense in which the paramitas compound themselves. So generosity is giving up the things that normally get us to work in the world, which are egotistical, such as we push our way through with anger, or we do something but we really have pride in it, which is our real motive, and so on. So awareness is being generosity is being willing to give that up, and discipline is sticking with that. That is, when we start to give up our trips about how we behave, how we give, and so on, then it becomes kind of frightening. We're there, and we have to. And if we're going to keep doing that, we have to keep maintaining it, and it can become painful to realize we can't go back. We've made this commitment. We're out there, and we're going to keep doing it. So this is what he says. It's pretty outrageous. You are a simple, straightforward, naked child without companions, without nipples. You cannot cry to anyone because nobody will come to get you. And you cannot ask for nipples because there is no such thing coming to you. So discipline is actually more a real appreciation of loneliness. So if we're going to do that, and we're not going to go back, and we've committed ourselves to not going back, we're going to find that there's a loneliness aspect to it. There's also a steadiness, because it overcomes getting excited and getting depressed about what we're doing. We're going to just continue. So it counters elation and depression. And not only is there a sense of being there lonely by ourselves, but we can't look for improvements. We can't say, well, now I've been generous and I've been disciplined, so now I want things to get better. So there's that element of not resenting that we got ourselves into this situation. And all that is part of the paramita of discipline, when we actually start to feel it and get a sense of the prajna behind it. I know I'm reviewing, but we got into some trouble last time, particularly with patience. So I think we got to pull back a little bit on anyone saying when bad things happen, that's good. We got ourselves into a bit of trouble with that last week. So maybe it's good, maybe it's not, but let's hold up on that. Patience is some fortitude in continuing the discipline. Not being angry, not being resentful, not looking for gratitude. Again, I'm going to quote Trungpa on this. Generosity is the stripping off process, and discipline is remaining in the loneliness. So we find all kinds of pains. In fact, we actually invite pain by being alone, by keeping our discipline properly. We are an owl in the daylight already by being alone. That's a strange image. And we are attacked from all directions by visible and invisible forces of all kinds, psychically, physically, all kinds of things. And patience is not getting resentful of that. Once there is resentment, we blow the whole thing up in some sense. Then we regress. So here there is a sense that we make ourselves vulnerable. Things can happen to us because we're on this path. And they might be exterior things, but they could also be that the demons inside us start to come up earlier than if we were not making this intense effort. And that happens precisely because we're increasing our awareness. We're starting to know our mind better, and we have to face our mind, and various kinds of fears and problems start to come up. So here we've got ourselves on this path, and not being resentful that we've got ourselves here, and continuing is important. So at least, do you have anything to say? It would be nice if Roberta were here, but she's not. You recall that interaction last week?
I'm trying to think which one about the self and no self.
It was about
taking in sort of.
Other yes, okay. How much can we take in
of other people's
suffering? Right, and we aren't taking it in to harm ourselves. That should be clear. We aren't bringing harmful things into our being deliberately, and you made the point that we're rather aerating the pain of others. Okay.
That awareness that there's a suffering and sort of taking sort of that awareness in, and then realizing there's also the ability to send out sort of that which people might need to come past the suffering. But it's not. I try to explain like the Tom Glenn and some teachers I work with, and they said, like, I don't have enough problems, I'm going to take in somebody else. I said, no, you're not taking them to hold them. You're taking them to turn them around.
And that's important. We're not trying to make ourselves sick with the practice. Anyway, it's a little difficult to hold a conversation when the person who brought it up isn't here. So I guess we'll just go on. Okay, so that now we have the last thing, which is the ones I'm supposed to do. And now we start to get a little different flavor here. When we are on a path, there's going to be ups and downs. We're going to go up, and there's going to be hard things, and then it's going to get easier. And there'll be hard things in the future, but now, with this next one, which is called exertion, something else is a little coming along. It's like we've crested the hill by sticking with it and being brave and not resentful and so on. And new energy comes to us. And it comes to us, I suppose it comes to us because we're starting to get glimpses of prajna now. It comes to us because of the commitment, and because we've picked up the practice of going beyond personal self, there's a little flip in terms of effort. And we start to see that actually holding on to samsara is more work than giving it up. This actually is so, but we don't see it because we don't have enough prajna. But sometimes we do. So this exertion is joyful. Now comes the quality of being on the bodhisattva path is joyful, and with it, because we're going beyond the personal self and we've been disciplining ourselves, there's more energy. We have more energy than we thought, because our energy up to that point has been walled in by this is me inside my wall, my egocentric holding back, and I don't have the energy to go outside it. And now we've been kind of pushing outside it, and the energy isn't so limited now. It's there's much more energy. There's the energy of the whole world moving through us instead of the energy that we're trying to trap and hold on to. Make sense? Yeah. So the nature of exertion is being delighted in the practice. Exertion is simply continuing what has happened already. There's a sense of delight, there's a sense of energy and joy, and we know that we can continue. We've crested that first level of obstacle. And that brings us to the fifth paramita, which is meditation. In Tibetan it's called samten, and in Sanskrit it's called dhyana. And dhyana, by the way, is a Sanskrit word which gave rise to the word chan in Chinese, which became zen in Japanese. Quite a change in the sound, but that's the origin of the word zen, dhyana. Samten means stability and solidity of mind from meditation. So it's more than just shamatha here. Again, I'm going to read Trungpa Rinpoche. The nature of samten is to cut any possible distractions, and its function is to develop some sense of groundlessness. So what comprises samten is a sense that you can watch what goes on in your mind, your thoughts, as a river flowing, watching a river flowing, or watching a mountain range. There is a sense of immense solidity which derives from the previous four jhanas. So meditation here is a real stability and being able to maintain our awareness and know what's happening. And it starts to give us groundlessness, which is to say, prajna. However, meditation without prajna is not complete. So to really have, like all the other paramitas, to really have transcendental meditation, we need prajna. So the sixth paramita, which I think we've been talking about all along in some way, at least, the Sanskrit word here is prajna, and the Tibetan word is sherap, and here we translate it as knowledge, and other people may translate it as wisdom. But by knowledge, we certainly mean, we don't mean knowing particular skills. It's the knowledge of shunyata, emptiness. And the reason that word was reserved is because there are more experiences beyond that, and therefore the word wisdom was reserved. So we'll call it knowledge here. But in other translations, you'll see wisdom. So prajna is a clear perception of the phenomenal world. Its nature is clear and precise because its allegiance is to emptiness, shunyata. Trungpa Rinpoche says, even if the bodhisattva has perfected the other five paramitas, lacking prajna, the other actions are incomplete. It is said in the sutras that the five paramitas are like five rivers flowing into the ocean of prajna. So we've had some examples of that already. We've talked about generosity. Without prajna, we don't have the full generosity, which is beyond the self. No giver, no receiver, no action. Discipline is the same thing. Without prajna, it comes down to working with a list of rules. And there's nothing wrong with those list of rules. They're very good ones. They keep society functioning and so forth. But with prajna, there's the discovery in each situation of what it is we have to do rather than needing a list of rules. So that applies to all the paramitas. So the paramitas are generosity, discipline, patience, exertion, meditation, and prajna.
I have a question about the meditation. So when they say meditation is going to mind, that includes like, I'm somewhere and I hear someone treating me a certain way, and instead of doing this sort of turn around and flashing back out, I sort of become aware of what's happening. Does that count as like the meditation they're talking about?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Okay. Right, so we have meditation in action and meditation on the cushion, yeah. Meditation should be, to the extent that we can do it, a 24 times 7 process. Any other? We could have a discussion at this point. Yeah?
Then meditation and mindfulness are the same.
Meditation has two parts, which are sometimes called mindfulness and awareness. In Sanskrit, shamatha, which is the developing of peace, the ability to be present here and not have our mind racing all over. And then awareness, which relaxes that, takes in a much larger context and actually starts to see the wisdom, the prajna aspect of it. So our training starts with shamatha and then vipassana or awareness can develop from there, and we can actually start to put them together. So the answer is this. Shamatha is the very important foundation, and then there's more to it. we have to go back and do a class which actually starts to work on this in detail at some point. Certainly by the fall we will.
I think the other thing Roberta had raised last week was that issue of her, was it last week or the week before, her concern that selflessness meant that I'm not important. Like, people don't have to treat me well because I'm not important or something. I remember.
It's sort of like trying to be, if someone has been trying to build up their self-esteem.
Yeah, okay. So, from any psychological point of view, we need a functioning ego, not a disintegrated one that is psychotic or non-dysfunctional. And that's certainly true. So to start to go beyond the self, one needs a functional self. So, for example, we don't usually give meditation instruction to psychotic people because they need to function first. So we always have a lot of confusion about that. But going beyond the self does not mean making our everyday self dysfunctional. It's certain, we can be very clear about that.
If we were speaking Sanskrit or something different, would these words be the same? Is the word for self and ego like...
Oh, that's wonderful, okay. So,
you know what I'm trying to say.
Yes, I know exactly what you're trying to say. So, the word Atman is, how do you translate that? Soul?
Yes.
Okay, so are we insulting the Hindus by using, by translating it as ego?
Don't worry about that.
Okay, so this, we're talking Buddhist language here, and the central aspect of Buddhism is called non-self, and we have to translate it into our culture, and which is different than the culture of India at the 2500 years ago when the Buddha was teaching, for example. And one of the big differences is that we have psychology today. And we have all kinds of psychology. We have the psychology of cognitive psychology and perceptual psychology and transpersonal psychology and so on. And that makes our language very tricky. And it'll continue to be tricky, unfortunately. So we are generally translating Atman as ego or self, and we are saying that it's ultimately a delusion, that emptiness sees that self or Atman really doesn't exist. Now, I'm sure you have other language which is quite different than that, and we just have to go with our language.
It's about like from Buddhism or Jainism or Hinduism, from their perspective, it's more like losing the identity itself of I. Like, we identify ourselves with all of the things which society sees us. So our roles, whatever we perform at work, how our relationships identify us, and then that's what is I. So losing that I is something very hard, like living in a materialistic world and losing that identity itself is something which we always struggle with. And Buddha or any of those paths really leads to losing that identity of I. And generosity and all those things follows through with that only. So when you have like somebody suffering, you cannot do much about it. Like somebody is a cancer patient, but he's going through that suffering. What you could do is, or I could do is, about showing compassion, being with the process, witnessing it, just feeling the like emotions or the heart, what the person is going through with the pain and all those things. So sometimes like we don't get an opportunity or we don't feel so sensitive about that process. Like I need to be there because I have so much involved with my work. 8 hours I have given to my work. Now it's my time. It's my wife. It's my kids. It's not my parents or somebody else. How can I give that time? So it's a process of going through. Just be with it. Like that automatically, like there is a more kind of the consciousness world kind of a thing. How we exist. Like there is a one thing about like self-inquiry. Who am I? If whatever in silence, like the emptiness which we are talking about, if we can keep trying ourselves, who am I? That question, when as soon we do, we'll identify ourselves. And if you keep identifying yourself, you lose like that identity itself. Like, who am I? I'm a soul. From where I came? How did I exist? How I took birth? Where is my source? As soon you try answering the question of who am I, it will direct to the source from where we originated or we existed. So it's really like really tricky kind of a thing, like it, like logics and all, like rational mind cannot like really conceive to such thoughts, like basically.
It almost seems to me as if losing the self or the emptiness, because empty sounds almost negative in our culture.
Yeah.
And I think it means, in a way, it's almost finding the core without the trappings.
Yeah.
And so that the superficial goes away, but what actually is in there may actually be, if you think about the psychological language, what's left may be, in psychology, a strong self.
Yeah.
Because it's not with the material, with the work, with the
attachments,
with all of the other attachments.
Right.
So it's almost contradictory with the language of the two disciplines.
So,
that's what is a catch with all languages. Like, mind works in duality. Always, either it would be too positive about things which we can think about, or we will get into negativity.
Mm-hmm.
Emptiness really means being witness to it. Emptiness doesn't mean like negativity about it. So it's a duality. We might be feeling too good about certain things. We might be feeling bad about certain things. But as soon we say empty, empty doesn't mean like completely shutting down something. Empty means you witness that moment.
It's getting rid of the preconceived
judgments and all those things need to be taken away. And you just witness without any judgment. That's what emptiness means, like from a cultural perspective.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And again, yeah, and when we will eventually get to the Buddha nature is the term we're going to use for the fullness of it. So, by the way, linguistically, the word ego, egotism, and so on, did not exist in the English language 150 years ago. You're aware of this?
Mm-hmm.
No, okay.
150 years?
I said 150. It came about because of Sigmund Freud. And when his writings were translated into English by Brill, he used the word ich, which is the German I, and Brill came up with the word ego, which is the Latin for I. And so all that language in English is due to has that origin. Just to complete our tangle of language here.
We often pick from all other languages, so yeah. Nothing specific to that, yeah.
Okay, so I wanted to say something, which we have a couple of minutes. So when we take the Bodhisattva vow, was it read last time? No.
We did.
Okay, and we can try reading it again at some point. It's online, too, on our website. When we take the Bodhisattva vow, if you recall it, there was a lot. It's very celebratory. It ends with sentient beings and gods and so on rejoice. That's the very last words of it. And when this is done as a public ceremony, and it is done in front of a teacher, and people take this vow, it's a celebration, and the celebration is often followed, in our culture at least, with some cocktails and food and general cheerfulness and so on. So there's a celebration. At the same time, it should be pretty scary. What did I get myself into? Because the vow we've taken, as long as we never retreat from it, is not that we can practice sometimes and then not practice sometimes, but that we're vowing to make our practice 24 times 7. In other words, not to retreat from awareness under any possible circumstances. We're not able to do that at this point, most of us. I certainly can't. But it could feel very claustrophobic, too, to when you first start to get the idea of what's being asked here. It could be frightening and claustrophobic. That I've taken a vow not to turn my awareness and compassion off at any time, while sleeping, dreaming, waking, working at my job, making love, cooking, whatever. And the tipping point there is sort of coming coming to realize that in itself is joyful, not frightening. In other words, there's a certain getting used to it. Even before we make a lot of progress on the path, I think we have to chew through that and get the idea that this is really where we're going.
Does that mean... Some days I feel like I just can't deal with the news.
Yeah.
Because it's just one, you know, and I feel like I can't offer anything to the people who are hearing one tragedy after another. So am I not showing appropriate compassion on that, or how do you balance?
No, it's not a matter that you can do it. It's that we've taken the resolve that we're moving in that direction, okay? We're not perfect bodhisattvas. It's just that we've cheerfully said we're setting out on the path, and that's the direction we're going in.
Is it sankalpa, like commitment?
What?
Sankalpa. Like a Sanskrit word is sankalpa for that. Like, is it commitment?
It is commitment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that word. Okay.
Yeah.
Good one.
Yeah.
But it definitely is commitment. Yes.
So it's similar to like a wedding vow.
Yeah.
You say, I'm going to do all these things, and I'm going to be nice to you all the time, and I'm going to love you all the time. Then you're like, oh, I'm trying.
Okay, well, actually, in the Buddhist wedding ceremonies, for instance, the one that I did, we do take the Bodhisattva vow. We make 6 symbolic offerings, which are the paramitas, and the couple take alternately bring the offerings up to the shrine. And there are specific offerings which are symbols of the 6 paramitas. But the Bodhisattva vow is a little more enduring than that, because most weddings are only until death. I mean, even if accepting the idea that it's not going to end in divorce, it still ends in death. But the bodhisattva vow does not. It should follow subsequent lives. You can't get out of it.
How many?
Endless eons of them. I have a little personal experience which might suggest how my teacher Trogyen Trungpa Rinpoche trained us, which might give some insight into what's going on here. And it just occurred to me to talk about this after Passover, because I went to two Passover feasts, two successive nights. You were there at one of them. And what I noticed was Passover is a feast where you have lots of food and lots of drink. In fact, you're encouraged to drink. And yet it's it's an occasion of mindfulness and ceremony at the same time. And I observed in both of them a sloppiness at the end, let's say, a loss of mindfulness. Both of them, that one and the one at my sister's house, in different ways. But I think it's fair to say that that was true. So when we did Vajrayana practices, and it took a long time to do these, you had to go through a lot of meditation, you had to go through at least a month of retreat, you had to go through seminary, you had to do the preliminary practices, which 100,000 of this, 100,000 of that, and so on. And you had to request Abhisheka, and it was frightening to go through the Abhisheka empowerment. And then finally you did this, and then you could go to these feasts. So a feast is, first of all, there's a lot of effort to set it up. There's a lot of materials that have to come together on the shrine and in the food preparation and in the drink preparation and many details. And then there's a long ritual, and the ritual starts with the mindfulness practice, then it goes on to bodhisattva practice, then it goes on to the Vajrayana practice, so it's pyramided, and you do all of this, and it takes about 4 hours to go through all the different parts of this to get to the feast. Then comes the feast, and alcohol can flow quite generously, and food can be eaten generously. There's some people who don't take alcohol, and that's okay. People who are recovering alcoholics typically don't, but other people do. And you have quite a bit of alcohol, and the feast is also a celebration. One could dance, one could recite poetry, one could just have lively and interesting conversation. But it should not get sloppy. That is, it should not involve slander or mindless gossip. Even if you're getting drunk, you hold it together. And then the feast part is over, and there's not too much ritual after that, but there's some, and you go through the ritual, and then there's more mindfulness practice at the end, at least 10 or 15 minutes, during which, even if you're drunk, you're back and you're in your good posture and you're doing your mindfulness practice. And then the whole thing is taken down and cleaned up, and because there's things happening like rice being thrown and so on, it's necessary to vacuum the carpets and clean up the dishes and do a lot of things, and people should stay and do the whole thing. So what is this saying in terms of this bodhisattva vow, which is 24 times 7. Do you see how we're being trained? And we can train ourselves in this sort of way by being mindful. Actually, if we've taken this vow, then we can abstain from meaningless chatter. We can have really nice conversations, but hold up on that. Hold up on slander and meanness of speech, and do it all the time. So this is, in a way, the way my teacher trained us to set forth upon such a path. To say we can hold our mind if we're drunk, we can hold our mind if we're sleepy. And it's not bad, it's not painful, we can actually do it. Anyone want to add anything? Yes?
I guess I'm real surprised that there's some kind of feast. Sounds like excess of food and drink. How were you prepared for that? Or were you told anything in terms of, well, now that it just seems so counter.
Why is it counter?
It just,
okay, we don't want to make this into a solemn thing. Okay?
Yeah, right.
Okay, it has to be a celebration.
And so is celebration always food and drink?
No. That's an example of a celebration, right? No, I mean, whatever we're doing can be a celebration. We don't have to lose our mind.
Which often happens, I think, because at the end of a Seder, you have all this food, and then conversation can kind of, here you've been having this experience of contemplating on suffering on both sides, and then suddenly you're eating, and then what, does it all fall apart, and do you not, in other words, you have to carry that consciousness into even your feasting.
Right through eating the afikoman.
I guess emptiness also sounds like asceticism.
I hope I didn't describe it that way.
No, none of this, but I'm realizing that's another one of those mental associations.
Yeah,
so when you said you're trying to empty, it just sounds like you're not supposed to be having sensory enjoyment. And so we have so many language things going on here.
Yeah.
No, I brought this up to make... to say why this is a celebration, and a joyful celebration. The bodhisattva, yes.
It feels to me as though it's freedom, and I can't imagine anything greater to celebrate. You know, to not be saddled with judgments and fears and. All these emotions that can just eat you alive, learning to sing. I don't have the right vocabulary, but
bliss.
I've lived long enough to know what I'm talking about. That, you know, myself can eat me alive, and I'm learning to be willing to stop that and find a way that allows me to be and allows life to come through me. Once again, I don't have the language, but I can't think of any more freedom than that. I can't think of any better reason to celebrate.
Right. And a good reason to get up at 6 if you have to practice, too.
Sure.
Because it's joyful. Yeah. There's bliss. Then there's beyond bliss, because you can't stop with bliss or you get caught in it. But that's a little ways at the moment. that it? So, oh, it's over there. This is the dedication of merit, which is important, because any benefit we have from this practice, we're willing to give away to all sentient beings.